Well, I think we'll get started. If people trickle in later, that's great. So thank you so much to everybody for coming and joining us on this very sunny evening. My name is Millie Lake. I'm an Associate Professor of International Security in the Department of International Relations here at LSE. I'm delighted to be here for one of the many launches for Dr. Kathy Dodworth's new book, Legitimation as Political Practice, Crafting Everyday Authority in Tanzania. And I'm really happy to have everybody here in the Wolfson Theatre today to discuss this book, which is really exciting intervention on everyday legitimation practices in coastal Tanzania that focuses on how non-governmental organizations craft their authority to act, working with, against, and through the state. This book is really close to my heart in many ways. I came to do my PhD wanting to study very similar things. I ended up kind of going in a slightly different direction, but it's really just wonderful to see this book published and to have had the opportunity to read it for this event. It's I really appreciate the push to theorize legitimacy and legitimation from below, coming from within a state society tradition myself. I have many questions and points of conversation from some of my own experiences from my own academic research and also as a former practitioner as well. So thank you to Kathy for being here. To present her book, Dr. Kathy Dodworth is a research fellow at the Centre of Africa Studies at the University of Edinburgh, and she's currently examining voluntary labour in Kenya. And the book that she'll present today is a result of her doctoral research in politics and international relations at Edinburgh University, which she finished in 2018 and which won the School of Social and Political Science Outstanding Thesis Award. We're really lucky to also have Dr. Elisa Gambino, who was one of our department's LSE fellows and has now left us for the University of Manchester. So we're really happy to welcome Ellie back to discuss the book tonight. Ellie's research, Dr. Gambino's research, focuses on China-Africa relations with a specific focus on Sino-African economic engagement in the infrastructure and mining sectors. She's recently been interested in the political dynamics characterizing the Ghanaian construction mining nexus, with a particular focus on transnational networks among Chinese and Ghanaian state and non-state actors. So she's really well placed to provide comments on the book today. As usual, there'll be a chance for you to put questions to the panel after we've finished hearing the presentations. How we'll work today is that I'll first turn over to Dr. Dodworth to present the book, and she'll speak for approximately, 20 minutes, 25? 40, perfect, great, that's 40 minutes. I am, my timings are on the other side of the document. And then we'll turn over to Dr. Gambino to provide some brief remarks. Depending how the time is going, we'll then either turn over back to Kathy to kind of respond to your comments, Ellie, or we'll just open it straight up to the audience at that point. So please do signal to me if you think you might have a question. I'll start taking a tally, and then I'll call on you as we open it up for a group discussion. And hopefully we'll have plenty of time for that, because it's always the most, in some ways, the most provocative and generative part of the conversation. So the hashtag for today's event, for those of you who want to tweet about it, is hashtag LSE Legitimation. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast, subject to no technical difficulties with the recording. So I'll say something more about that at the start of the Q&A. In the meantime, I'll turn over to you, Kathy, and we'll look forward to the talk.
Great. Thank you so much for those of you who made the effort to be here. It's exam time. I know there's a lot of pressures on everybody, so I'm extremely grateful. thank you, the LSE support staff, professional services, and Millie for agreeing to chair today. Ellie, thank you once again. You've done a lot of work on the organisational side. You've been so supportive of this piece of work. I'm getting slightly alarmed how I'm going to find a way to return the favour. Yes, you've been absolutely pivotal to this event, and I'm really grateful. So yes, my book, it's called Legitimation as Political Practice, and it looks like it's about NGOs, but really it's about both state and non-state actors in coastal Tanzania. So basically it's about how these developmental actors get people to do what they want them to do. So that makes it sound like a development studies book, but it's not just that. It is to some degree an IR book. IR is my home discipline. And I've been challenged on that in the past, you know, whether this sort of legitimation practice in coastal Tanzania is too niche. I've even been told Africa is niche by an IR scholar before, which makes, you know, my head explode. But this book is trying to pick up a conversation of something that I feel has been neglected in discussions about legitimation in IR theory, in global governance, obviously tend to focus on United Nations or the EU or similar intergovernmental organisations. But my interest is how legitimation is replicated all the way down. So those are NGOs that are assumed to confer legitimacy to the EU or the WTO, how do they build theirs in the first place? So it is often pre-assumed that NGOs have particular intrinsic or inherent legitimacy. But what I'm trying to unpick is this sort of very broader sort of global ecosystem of ideas and materialities that build this legitimacy from the bottom up. This is a result of fieldwork that happened a good while now ago, over a decade, and this book was almost never written. So originally, the original rationale was an attempt to link more formal modes of governance, how an NGO was constituted, for example, and whether that transferred into meaningful perceived legitimacy on the part of the groups that NGOs work with. Ripped that up quite early on, and I'll come back to why. The book was almost never written as well because I became extremely unwell after the birth of my son, to the point where it took a couple of years before I could even read and write again and hold conversations like we're going to have today. So it's been a hell of a journey, I can tell you that much. It's not something I shy away from talking about. It's right there in the preface. And lastly, the book was almost not written because of COVID, so I'm sure there's a lot of people in the room struggling with all of those competing pressures and demands on your time. So there's a lot of other people's work, a lot of other people's labour that's gone into this book, especially childcare, a lot of tag teaming. Be familiar with those of you who've got young kids, thinking back to that really difficult time. So for all those reasons, it's very hard to believe I'm on this kind of rock and roll book tour of Europe promoting a book that I wrote. So I'm proud to be here and delighted to be in conversation with scholars at such a prestigious institution. So apparently we're in a crisis of legitimacy. Yeah. To give you an example, last year, House Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez told us after the US Supreme Court overturned federal abortion rights. So she said the court's opinion no longer reflects a broader public opinion, but also trust in the court itself is at an all-time low. You could point to a similar crisis of legitimacy right now. The UK's Metropolitan Police, just last month, public trust dipped under 50%. This is what I sometimes call the Tinkerbell effect, you know, that institutions are deemed they're no longer legitimate because people no longer believe in them. This draws from a sort of long-standing Weberian tradition whereby legitimacy, similarly, is defined often as a shared belief. And not only a shared belief in something being right or wrong or acceptable, but shared belief in legitimacy itself. And many IR people revisiting this topic, it's had a bit of a renaissance in the last decade or so, still formulating legitimacy in that way. So aside from whether I agree with AOC's politics, which I do, personally, after years now of trying to study and to unpack what we mean by legitimacy and how it's used, I very much moved away from what I call the attributive brand, so that something either is legitimate or it's not. But people have been working on this attributive brand for a very, very long time. You could even argue it's one of the earliest debates we have in political philosophy. So there's a huge number of flowcharts and tables that I've tried to digest where people or scholars are aspiring to give a very complete, exhaustive account of legitimacy and all of its variables. So how does that translate to the everyday? A couple of things have become apparent to me over time. Firstly, who uses the word? And often it's scholars, commentators, politicians often wield the word legitimacy also. But secondly, and maybe more importantly, understanding legitimacy as a shared belief, and especially a shared belief in legitimacy, is almost impossible to research. So I don't think we speak in those terms. I'm not sure whether we really think in them either. You know, we might talk about trust, we might talk about confidence, you might try and retroactively fit those notions to legitimacy, but we ourselves don't necessarily feel legitimacy. So I'm not feeling it. So firstly, I don't necessarily spend time forming conscious, stable beliefs in legitimacy about the United Nations or the Met or any single institution. And those who were involved in the research, they didn't either. So the rightness or wrongness of a particular intervention may be, good and bad may be, legitimate not so much. And secondly, if we do spend time forming these beliefs, do we hold them collectively? Probably not. All of our mediating beliefs, experiences, backgrounds, interests, barriers to holding this shared belief in the legitimacy of any particular institution. But this idea of a shared belief and this moment of agreement is the founding story of many of our institutions. And I sometimes call it the ether of political theory, in that our current kind of westernized transactional notion of politics and of political institutions don't make sense without it. So we are bound, in a way, to forever theorize its contents. And before I get into that, around sort of theorizing or anti-theorizing around legitimacy, just to roll back a little bit on this idea of crisis. So the idea is many in Western democracies experiencing a protracted legitimacy deficit, manifest through disaffection with public institutions, there's long-term economic stagnation, weakening norms. And then also, we have these seemingly new non-state actors on the block, including NGOs. What do we do with them? So how do they fit in to our pre-existing governance arrangements? What I suggest in the book, and I'm not the first to do this, obviously, is that some of these elements deemed crises have had a very long generative history in the colonized world. Especially non-state actors, obviously originally companies, but now NGOs are very much an everyday part of governing public as well as private spheres. Also, many things often happen in Africa first, as Mbembe argued, often in more pronounced forms. So these ambiguous modes of governance we're witnessing, straddling notional divides between the state and the non-state, the local and the global, public and private, long established in many post-colonial contexts. So do we see crisis, or do we see something more productive, something more like continuity? Additionally, throughout the book, I try to screen for what Stoller would term the imperial debris scattered across many legitimacy debates, whether it is, as I say, in writing or deeming what is a crisis or what is a norm, but also especially in this mythology of writing how our institutions are born. So in a lot of Western legitimacy scholarship, the idea is that the legitimate institution is there, intervention follows. But in many colonized contexts some of you may be familiar with in this room, intervention has been the regime. So that's the backdrop to my book. That's why I wrote it, so lay it out really. Number one motivation, long-standing fixation in Western political philosophy with capturing legitimacy, all of its causal components. But then what? You know, if something is deemed illegitimate, which is happening so much right now, do you know, what changes, what stops, or do we see new evolving ways of working? Secondly, these liberal era Enlightenment inspired assumptions, especially this idea of a transaction in institutional life, a contract between a consenting public and its institutions. This moment of consent, did that happen? And did it happen in most of the world? And lastly, and this is a biggie that I haven't touched on yet, legitimation is as much about the audience. So there's a lot of studies look at how particular messages or symbols or ideas are transmitted downwards to these rather unwitting audiences who simply consume it. And a lot of legitimacy studies in Africa have done similar, in which case the focus is very much on elite spaces. So the data might be speeches, might be manifestos, it might be rallies. So I've been trying to make my study as much about the audience as the so-termed elite. So this is why I did a study into legitimation and I used practice-based inquiry to do it. I don't fixate a huge amount on definitions for fear of falling into those same sort of causal models, but on screen is my best attempt to define my working definition of legitimation. So yeah, the more I studied, the more I sort of began to identify these collection of different overlapping practices. These practices imbue power with various ideational and material capital, and power becomes, even if very temporarily, authority. So I do appreciate at this point that nobody uses the word legitimation either, but the difference here, I'm not claiming that there's any sort of fixed shared belief, and I'm not making a moral claim around something being legitimate or not. I simply use the word, it's the closest that I've found in the literature to the phenomenon that I'm trying to explore, but it is very much divorced from legitimacy. So it's not like you do some legitimation and some legitimacy pops out at the end. It's more you do some of this and you get some people to do what you want them to do some of the time, but it is very much ephemeral and partial, and it leads to a sort of constant negotiation and renegotiation. So yes, and I study NGOs. It's not an NGO study specifically. I began to look at state actors too, because the overlapping practices, the practicalities, and sometimes even the people were becoming very obvious to me. And this I call the non-state, so the non-forward/state. And the reason I looked at coastal Tanzania, when there was a huge rush of this non-forward/state activity in that area. But of course, historically, there were many different ideas and materialities at play. The colonial history of Tanganyika more broadly, as a German colony, and then a British so-termed protectorate. And then, of course, post-independence, turn towards socialist beliefs under the first president, Nyerere. after his demise, rapid liberalisation of the market, and now we're in this sort of post-liberal era whereby some of those socialist ideas, collectivities still resonate, but within the backdrop of growing inequalities and in a liberalising marketplace. And then within Tanzania, I look at Bagamoyo. It had become this on the coast, and it had become quite marginalised during the nationalist anti-colonial movement. And so it became an area that had been quite overlooked. It was struggling to perform very low development indices, which had caused a further rush of non-state activity. And these different histories played out particularly in things like representational practice, which I'll come back to. Something else I go into in the book is how legitimacy has been applied to Africa, in particular, where the sort of imperial debris becomes quite obvious or more visible. So while I definitely subscribe to some things around Weberian method and approach to social inquiry, his three forms of legitimation, so famously traditional, charismatic and rational, it's the traditional legitimacy that is still quite liberally applied to African contexts, sometimes often contrasted subtly with the rational legitimacy, which, whether Weber would concede or not, was for him the more superior kind. Lots of neo-patrimonial analysis in Africa, dominant in the 80s and the 90s, drew from a subform of traditional legitimacy to paint a picture of a continent in its infancy, immature or irrational institutions, a continent stuck in a violent, difficult past. So obviously so many problems with this that others have already contended with, but I'll pick up on just two here. So there's no audience in neo-patrimonial analysis. So again, the sort of mute public captivated by the big man without the political sophistication to contest them. And secondly, money talks, so the politics of the belly, who eats first. So this sort of problematic, sometimes racist, underlying thinking, certainly in the early neo-patrimonial analysis. Those issues aside, as Mkanda Wiri wrote famously now when taking aim at neo-patrimonialism some years later, ideas matter too, and often they matter the most. So my book definitely focuses more on ideas, or the collection of ideas that give meaning to action. So I talk about five in the book. One is the creation of political space, boundaries, turfs by state and non-state actors. Secondly, I talk about the idea of the state, in this case, the sort of developmental, all-encompassing post-socialist state in Tanzania. Thirdly, I talk about voluntarism. Fourth, about representation. And then fifthly, I do talk about materiality, so I don't abandon it entirely in form of focusing on ideas. But here I talk about information or data. So information, obviously a material resource, but even then I talk about how ideas are important in the production of information, in its extraction, in its sharing, and then its ultimate conversion into funding. There's a couple of things the book doesn't really talk about, and religion is one of them. And party politics are there operating in the background, but I don't focus on those areas specifically in the book. The sort of data regarding developmental, everyday developmental activity didn't really take me there, but I do appreciate that these are core ideas in the Tanzanian context. So I'm going to talk about three of these today on the top row, voluntarism, representation, and then the materiality. Before I take a deep dive into those though, I just want to touch on how we tried to capture some of these ideas within the book cover. So some people hated this cover, some people liked it. We just tried to do something different. We wrote a blog about it for LSE. We obviously had to tread very carefully. So given this problematic history of representing and essentializing African contexts, representing Africa either aesthetically or politically, historically, sometimes those have been intertwined. So in order to push back against that, we did two things. So firstly, these photographs on which it's based were actually taken by NGOs in the course of their work, so with appropriate permissions, and we used different ways to protect identities. So in a sense, we're also exploring NGOs' representations of their own work. And secondly, we promote this young woman at the front, this audience member, to be the key protagonist. So behind this young woman, a legitimation scene is playing out. And the NGO is this employee is very much practicing. He's moving around, he's speaking very authoritatively, performatively. And on that day, he was making claims of superior representation on the part of his NGO as compared to the next NGO, but also as compared to local government, who he said had forgotten this particular village. And then the audience is there, it's very much part of it. Some of them were convinced, some were not, some were mocking him. He's also trying to draw a boundary around them. He's forming a new constituency, in a sense. And he's also straddling these different spaces here. In some ways, he was very state-like in his arrival and how he was welcomed and how he was seated and arriving in this Land Cruiser. But in other ways, he's a much better orator and he's connecting with people in a much less hierarchical fashion than somebody from local government. And some colleagues have interpreted this as a sort of shadowy, sinister figure, you know, not far away from the big man trope that the book moves away from, which was not the intention. This man was very likeable and he was making very strong connections with people and talking to them with respect and almost as equals. So we really just wanted to background him in order to promote the audience. This young woman at the front, she's not at all convinced at the scene going on behind her, very ambivalent as to whether to join, because she understands what's going to be asked of her. You know, she's got a lot of other responsibilities. She has a lot of stuff to do. And she's staring right back at the onlooker as if to question the challenge, the right of that visitor to be there. So it was the book artist, Chris, who first noticed this young woman and was very much drawn to her expression, the ambivalence, the humour, the fatigue. And the more we talked about her, the more we realised she encapsulates many of the themes of the book, especially the burdens of volunteering, juggling different responsibilities. In her Kitingi rap there, you might be able to see the words majukum, meaning responsibilities in Swahili, which is what she shouted one day after being mucked about for a third day in a row by a particular NGO. So that vignette is quite a powerful one towards the end of the book. So this lets me segue into voluntarism, so this idea, ethic of unpaid time for a common good. A lot of different ideas are layered into that. So during Nyerere's time, weekly conscripted labour, but existed before that, but it was Nyerere that had this concerted drive towards self-reliance. By the 90s and the 2000s, you had the rediscovery of voluntarism by Western actors, exported again by Western donors, especially through NGOs. So every single NGO that I spoke to, which was over 30, they used volunteers in some way to service particular goals. So in recruiting volunteers, we see there are multiple ideas again at play. So this sort of, you can see the fusing of these sort of donor scripts with a legacy of community service from Nyerere's era. But the volunteers do a lot of work for NGOs, now not just like literally, but they legitimate NGOs. So for example, they convey an idea of an NGO working at scale, so across a district and at depth, if you have a volunteer in every single village. And many NGOs that were working in Bagamoyo were able to claim to be district-wide by virtue of having a recruited volunteer in every one of its 97 villages. It also conveys an idea of consent. So if you're able to have an active volunteer on your book, it's almost a validation in some way of that village or that community of the NGO's work. But then, of course, the reality for those volunteers themselves, so many challenges and burdens and tensions in voluntary labour. There are benefits, of course. There were personal benefits, benefits to the wider community as well. I'm not disputing that. But I am sort of challenging this idea of this quite westernised idea of voluntarism, of volition. I met many people who were ascribed to that work, and many people who continue to do it, but they didn't want to, or they didn't at least choose to. And often people find it very difficult to stop for lots of different reasons. In the book, for one example, I explore a volunteer story during an NGO's monitoring visit, when they entered into the village office and found the volunteer, and there were a whole load of photos on the wall of these vulnerable children that were part of the NGO's project. They were grilling her for questions, and she's saying, where's this person now? Give us as much data as possible. And this woman eventually, after being grilled for 5 or 10 minutes, just snapped and sat down, and she said, I've been doing this work for 8 years. I want to stop. People can find ways to stop, of course. They can evade the work that they've been assigned, they can avoid the NGOs, they can avoid local government, they can disappear. I think in this day and age you might call it lying flat or quietly quitting. But I felt some of these different tensions and competing responsibilities and duties within voluntarism is quite well encapsulated by this quote. And I asked a local woman during a monitoring visit, when did you first volunteer? She said, no, I didn't volunteer. I was chosen. It's the work that's voluntary, which means here specifically unpaid. Moving on to representational practice, this is a real biggie. For the Tanzanian state as well, but specifically here, existentially critical for non-government organisations. So NGOs, the idea that they can represent particular groups and advocate for their interests better than government or better than anybody else. So in this chapter, I try to bring anti or post-colonial insights to bear on Western representational theorising, to try and screen for elements of this imperial debris. So I draw from Fanon and later Memmi around how representational practice, whether it's aesthetic or political, and as I say, they can often fuse, representational practice actually brings a particular group into being. So rather than amplifying the needs of a pre-existing group, and all these writers were writing long before the so-called constitutive turn in representational theory, and long before Edward Said translated Foucault into post-colonial studies. So I use these earlier works to engage with Hannah Pitkin's work on representation, quite a canon of representational theory, specifically the idea of acting for others versus standing for others. So you act for someone if you are in a better position to understand their long-term interests. So that is substantive representation. You stand for someone if you look like them, or if you're closer to them, if you are somehow one of them. So that is descriptive representation. In the book, I explore how representation is actually an oscillation between these two. And you find one often collapses into the other, and often into quite problematic tropes. So NGOs stand for marginalised groups, but of course when projects start to fail or when people don't understand properly, they suddenly need to act for them. And at that moment, they become trustees. And trusteeship, of course, was core to the whole colonial or late colonial project. So in this quote, an NGO worker who was very unusually actually from Bagamoyo area, she was extremely agitated after monitoring because nobody had done the work. And she said, these people, they just sit, which could also translate as just stand still or stay the same. So some of this, if you're interested in development policy, quite topical, this sort of growing movement to say, just give poor people money directly, stop with the evangelizing, quit the workshops, cut out the middleman. It's not always that simple, but you know, perhaps it could be. Trust that people understand their own interests. And then the last theme I included, because you could very reasonably argue that, you know, ideas are not enough and they also have materialities, and ideas perhaps wouldn't mean almost nothing without some form of materiality. So yes, I wrote this chapter as a response to my PhD examiner, Rita Abrahamson, who wondered whether I was neglecting some elements of the political economy of development. And I had a lot of data on this, but there was a balance in that I didn't want the book to sort of concede that legitimation is purely bought. It's not just that sort of transaction, but I did agree that materialities needed more attention. So this chapter explores not only how actors require some form of claim to authority in order to collect data, but how becoming repositories of data also then reinforces or serves to craft public authority of a kind. And given how fungible data is, it proved that the most sort of problematic flashpoint for anger and dissent, people getting very angry when NGOs are trying to gather data when they don't necessarily see tangible benefits over the long term, NGOs getting very angry when other NGOs gather their data or become experts or data houses on a particular issue. Interesting relationship with local government. I witnessed that the district were quite happy to relinquish control on reporting, particularly on those aspects that are notoriously difficult to monitor or to demonstrate impact. So things like human rights, for example, definitely concede that NGOs, you continue to monitor that aspect of work. So there was an interesting sort of symbiotic relationship between government and NGOs as far as sort of surveilling and monitoring local populations. So yes, gathering data goes to the very nub of creating and contesting public authority. I have a new project now in Kenya. I'm looking at health volunteers there. And a defining image for me around the datification of healthcare is disciplining these volunteers every month over the phone on phone calls, saying we need more data, data is money, data is more funding, was what one particular NGO worker said. And I remember at one point a volunteer pushed back and said, data, data, I can't create more sick children for you if I don't have them in my household. So these volunteers finding themselves at the bottom of a large sort of global ecosystem of information gathering and witnessing part of its commodification. Working for free, extremely stressful. So yes, people were demonstrating how tired they are of that, working at the bottom of that particular information tree. Okay. My throat's actually, my voice is going, so it's probably good that I'm ending at this point. I don't have a very dramatic finish or anything. I wanted to tell some stories, and I wanted to tell some stories that had underpinned or led to some of the theorising or anti-theorising around legitimacy. I hope you got something from that, and I'm really grateful for your attention. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kathy. That was really wonderful insight into the work that you've done in the book. And I have, many, many follow-up questions to ask you, but I'll cede the floor to Ellie first of all. Do you want to stand or sit?
I'll sit, it's fine. Perfect. Yeah. Thank you so much, and thank you, Kathy. It is always a pleasure, the third time around, listening to the presentation of your book. It's an absolutely brilliant piece of work, and I'm very excited to have the pleasure of discussing the content as well. I think it does an excellent work of highlighting some of the key blind spots of IR legitimacy theory, of course, and it goes beyond this very static, binary, and almost nostalgic understanding of legitimacy as something you have or you don't, and instead it combines this extremely rich ethnographic data. Every chapter is extremely goes in great depth, but also very personal stories that really come out. And the theoretical discussions really bring to the forefront this idea of legitimation as an accumulative practice that really encompasses sort of these different aspects of power, ideational, material, but also symbolic, perhaps. And your book, as you mentioned, outlines these sort of six practices, and two of them are extensity and territoriality. But all of the six of them are carefully defined, however interlinked and interconnected, which is something that you highlight very well in the book, and you paint a picture of the making of legitimation in postcolonial context that is truly outstanding. So well done, very proud of it. But today, for my comments, I'd like to focus on what is perhaps a bit closer to my own disciplinary home. And so I'd like to focus on the extensity and territoriality aspect, and hopefully this will also inspire you all to go and read the rest of the book since you haven't discussed them in the presentation. And you discuss spatial extensity and territoriality. You distinguish between an inclusionary movement. Spatial extensity is a practice that is aimed at projecting scale and depth. So you mentioned it briefly in the presentation, for example, having volunteers in each of the villages within the district of Bagamoyo. But in the book, you also outline how often these structures mimic those of the state authority and intertwine as well. But you also discuss this extensity with temporal extensity, and so ensuring that, that there is a permanence across time of the authority of a specific NGO. I think it does a very good job at engaging with different perceptions of time in the chapter that discusses extensity, and also the one that discusses territoriality, which instead you see as an exclusionary practice. You managed to talk about different temporalities vis-a-vis the state, and I think one question that really raised for me was the different temporalities or experiences of time that of those that are involved in the practices of legitimation. So, for example, volunteers, how do they perceive time when it's discussed differently from the way that the NGO perceives time with an objective of remaining for in the continuum? And the second aspect that you discuss in terms of space is the one of territoriality, which you explore as being exclusionary, and it engaged with debates on territorialization. And I wanted to perhaps conclude with a question, so hopefully that will lead into more questions, and on maybe elaborating a bit further on the relationship between spatial practices of legitimation and state territoriality, especially because in the conclusion you talk about how they intersect, these dynamics intersect and unfold, and in the context of Magufuli's rule. So you kind of prompt that discussion, talking about NGOs within authoritarian capitalism. And so I wanted to perhaps hear a bit more of the segue of this story. So what happens when the position of Bagamoyo changes vis-a-vis the center? And I know that the party politics is not the focus of the book, but I would really be interested in hearing a bit more on this relationship. Thank you.
Can you spell out that second question again, the relationship between
So the dynamic special practices of legitimization and how they intersect and unfold in the context of what you term in the conclusion NGO, authoritarian capitalism. So specifically when the position of Bagamoyo changes as Magufuli came into power. Obviously Kikwete was from Bagamoyo. There was also lots of development plans around the time that you conducted your fieldwork, I imagine, you know, the big port. And so what happens when the district position vis-a-vis the center of power changes, and what does that impact some of the speciality of these practices? Thank you.
Thank you, Ellie. So, Kathy, do you want to just maybe respond briefly to the direct questions that Ellie posed, or would you prefer that I take some questions from the audience first?
I will have a go. I've got quite a simple question answer to your first question. So in that chapter, I try to explore or to separate out extensity from territoriality, which are often seen to coextend at the borders of the state. And I was fascinated, I suppose, by interventions from non-state actors that changed or shaped political space in some ways. So I sort of spoke socially around the creation of a particular constituency. But in one case, an NGO actually managed to create a village. So in building a school, that NGO were able to amplify claims on the state that there should be a village there. And lo and behold, it was once you're declared a village, then you are, you know, you have rights in order to receive particular services. And so they had this very strong territorial claim over that village. It says, this is our village, this is an Advocates International village. And they very much had a particular relationship with that village that worked to actually exclude in practice other NGOs making claims to operate there. So the space for other NGOs to operate was almost completely foreclosed. Different temporalities, it's a good question, because NGOs are a relatively new history there in Bagamoyo. I think the vast majority I was doing had registered within the previous sort of 5 years. And so sort of claims to authenticity for NGOs having existed before 2005, before Kikwete came to power, they were able to make a sort of additional claim of authenticity and being there at a sort of the developmental inception almost was used in a way to bolster particular claims. But of course the viewpoint of beneficiaries with much longer standing histories of development and change in those particular villages, not least in one of the villages that I explore, where this huge sort of increasing demand for land, its proximity to Dar es Salaam meant it was being enveloped into the growing commuter belt. And actually that increase of money, of resource into the village allowed it to almost decouple or to remove itself from some elements of district authority. So they were taking some district office bearers to court over court cases, the misappropriation of land, and the district were seen to be part of this racket and not working in the interests of the village. So in a sense, as compared to other areas in the district that were more reliant on state intervention, this village and its leadership were proving constant thorn in the side of district postholders. I don't have a great answer for your second question. My data really didn't stretch beyond 2013. And I guess in the conclusion, I was sort of perhaps pointing to this more authoritarian turn and the restriction of space for NGOs who very much fallen out of favour at that time. But I wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't necessarily be able to say how it impacted different spatial politics and realities in Bagamoyo past that date, so apologies.
So let me open up to the floor and maybe we can start with Kathy. If we have more hands, I could take a couple of questions at once and then turn over to Kathy, and then we can take another round. Other Kathy.
So I'm Catherine Boone, government and ID here at LSC. So thank you for the talk. It's extremely intriguing. I also like the slides and the artwork. So, but I was wondering, you know, and it, I heard Ellie say something like, you know, if you want to know, you can buy the book. But I'm very intrigued to have more of a descriptive sense of what you're actually describing, as it were. So, like, what are these NGOs and what are they doing? What do they think they're doing? And I think you said the UN system, so is this like UNESCO or, you know, what are they doing? And, you know, it's very difficult to imagine people doing unpaid volunteer work for anyone. Like, why in the world would someone offer free labor for some oppressive outsiders for 8 years? I mean, it's just, it is kind of unimaginable without additional context. So I just wonder if you could describe a little more about who these NGOs are and what they're doing and how they get in there and what volunteers do and why anybody would, I mean, I could see if they were being paid, the story would somehow tumble more easily into place, but unpaid is just completely mysterious.
Okay. Yeah, thank you for the question. I probably should have attended to that a wee bit more at the beginning. So there were 130 something registered NGOs in Bagamoyo. So that doesn't include community-based organisations, which were undocumented, but probably were several hundred also. The vast majority of these were local NGOs, so operational in Bagamoyo only, and very ad hoc, sort of piecemeal. If money came in, there would be sort of some kind of small activity, perhaps a workshop, perhaps a seminar. So in the end, I ended up, for the sort of in-depth ethnography, selected on six NGOs that had a sort of continuity of operation. Two of them were international in the sense that they were headquartered outside of Tanzania. And then the rest were also local, so they weren't national. So national in Tanzania is when you're registered in two districts. So at that time, I did a sort of mapping exercise. The vast majority selected good governance as the primary activity, or that's how they identified their core activities. There were a lot of good governance workshops happening at that time, which are caused a lot of consternation and frustration with local populations. And one guy I remember stood up and said, "Good governance, you know, I haven't eaten today." But also second after that was HIV. So that was definitely a core area. So it really sort of was shaped by donor trends of 2012, whereby there was still this residual focus on good governance, whatever that might mean, HIV and AIDS, and human rights. So one of the international organizations was focused on, their volunteers were called community justice volunteers, and they were tasked with trying to monitor human rights violations within the village, which might involve gender-based violence, and encourage those people to go to report it to the police. That's extremely problematic, often putting those who report the crime at more at risk, extremely stressful work for the community justice facilitator themselves to be intervening in what are seen as very private disputes. And HIV activities, it would be perhaps sort of supporting micro financing, income generating projects, perhaps some advocacy around HIV/AIDS. But you did find that they were, especially the smaller NGOs, were quite reactive and would change in how they identify depending on what new money was available. Why would people volunteer? Well, I follow the story of several volunteers. I guess I try to unpack some hangover, I suppose, from the Nyerere era, whereby village executive officers could just ascribe or assign voluntary work to a particular person who may be well known already for doing voluntary work. So I interviewed volunteers who say, well, I'm the volunteer. So I met volunteers who were working for 3, 4, 5 different organizations at once. There are stipends. I think there's more probably now than when I was conducting my field work. But it's not just actually the cash in hand necessarily. Well, firstly, this one volunteer was quite proud of being, he liked being known to government, he said, so he'd like to be that person, that reference point, that local expert, and enjoyed the education and training that he received. Sometimes also it's the anticipation of future benefits somehow, that being recognised in that position may one day lead to something else. I think in that particular context, you know, you really sort of sense it's very palpable the force of the state in that, in you know, an NGO comes and says, we need a volunteer, and they said, this is your guy, and they don't necessarily have an exit route. I am working currently with the Community Health Volunteers in Kenya, so fast forward another decade, and people, part of their own volition, but perhaps part chosen, in some cases they're disadvantaged in some ways. So an outsider comes to a community and they're saying, well, this is your gig now, and they use that labour in order to climb socially and to be accepted within a community. It's difficult to stop in that case, so with community health volunteers in particular, when they've been doing that work for so long, so they've had the training, they've had the investments, so there's this form of kind of institutional lock-in. Many of them were anticipating future benefits that never came. And when we asked any of them, do you feel you could stop? And they're saying, well, how do I turn around after 15 years? And some of them, I found, who had been volunteering since the early 80s. And they said, how on earth do I turn around and say to my neighbour, I know you trusted me with all of this health information, you know, around your family planning and so on, but I don't want to do it anymore. I'm going to hand over to this guy. So people were explaining the very strong pressures they felt to continue to do the work, and they continue to do so in the hope that one day in the Kenyan context they would be salaried. And there is finally discussion about that under the new administration of Ruto, but we will see. So I'm not saying it's completely indentured labour, I'm just saying that it's extremely difficult. If somebody cannot stop something, can we say that it's voluntary in the same way as we might sort of assume in a more kind of liberal political theory type context? I don't know if that answers some of the questions.
Thank you. More hands. I also have a question. Yeah, go ahead. You can just say your name as well.
Hi, congratulations on your new book. My name is Yin. I'm a master's student from IR department. My question is actually about the opposite of legitimation, which is delegitimation, because towards the end, you briefly mentioned people are getting angry towards these NGOs, and NGOs are getting angry with other NGOs' practices. So I assume there are issue areas where the NGOs, they can't satisfy what people want. And what do people do with this dissatisfaction, and how do they challenge the practices, this legitimation, this legitimacy from these NGOs or states practices, and under what conditions would this delegitimation success, or under what condition would they fail? That's my question. Thank you.
Do you want to take that one, Kathy, or do you want a question with you as well?
Yeah, great question. I think the ultimate result of delegitimation is that you can't get anybody to do what you want them to do. So I sort of touched on in response to Ellie of this quite extreme case whereby the very successful legitimation of a land rights advocacy international NGO that was very at home with taking local government to task, the complete alignment with the village with that particular NGO had led to the complete delegitimation of other NGOs that were working in perhaps a more conventional partnership model. So the other international NGO, in which was very intermeshed with local government authority, so you had NGO staff members forming board members for example, coordinating bodies on all HIV/AIDS activities in the county. This NGO said, you know, I'm pretty much 50% government anyway, you have to do what I say. And it was interesting to see the sort of evasion tactics of the village leadership and the volunteers from this sort of more state-like NGO. But I guess what I try and do in the book is show that it's sort of, it's not ever necessarily as black and white as that. So it's a sort of constant renegotiation. One of the volunteers, this man I was telling you about, volunteered for five different organizations, and one of them just abandoned, he felt particularly abandoned by one. It ran out of funding and it didn't necessarily inform any of its volunteers that it wasn't operating anymore. He felt so hurt, he turned up at the office with his reports and no one was there anymore. And he sort of reflected on it and said, but you know, there was impact. They did help my kin. And I said, what if they came back? And he said, well, we would have to see. So there'd be a new negotiation, I think, of terms in an informal sense. I think your question is sort of very much, sounds quite binary. And I think what I'm trying to do in the book is explore every part of that spectrum, and that extreme case whereby an NGO couldn't even operate there, and the other where they were perfectly in tune, and everything else in between.
Thanks, Kathy. Other questions? Maybe I can ask a kind of follow up on that, I think, or at least on your answer to that, which is. In the book itself, you've kind of just touched on some of this in your answer. There's a lot of variation among the different NGOs that you worked with, both in terms of their practices and also in terms of their kind of characteristics, their depth of embeddedness, their relationship with the state, etc. And I'm thinking particularly of that comparison that you just gave between AAI and VPI, the one being more state embedded and kind of almost in some ways, I guess I read that as a little bit more status quo reinforcing, and the other organization being a bit more confrontational in its approach. I'm wondering if you could say something about those different characteristics and also the other sources of variation you saw in the NGOs you worked with, and what those different qualities or characteristics meant for different practices of legitimation, like what that meant, kind of that variation meant for the ways that they construct authority. Because that, I think, came out really well in the book and in the talk. Wasn't such a focus of the slice that you presented today. And then the kind of second question, maybe following on from that, is really about in that construction of authority and that kind of iterated practice of trying to what I read as building legitimacy, even though I know you are kind of telling us that this process of practices of legitimation isn't the same as building legitimacy. It's not that more legitimation leads to greater legitimacy, but who the kind of audiences of those practices are in the communities that the NGOs are embedded in, and what that reception kind of looks like in terms of the varied practices. Do those questions make sense? So I guess the first is about the variations in both legitimating practices and qualities of the NGOs themselves, and whether those two things map onto each other. And the second question is really just about reception among local communities and what that those practices of legitimation look like for the communities, not the volunteers necessarily, but the other members of the community, potentially service users or other audiences or participants in the community.
When you say qualities of NGOs, do you mean like whether they were local or international, or what size
that
they were?
Or state affiliated, not state affiliated, differences between their approaches to the state, their kind of political affiliations, maybe whatever sources of variation were salient actually in terms of how those mapped onto what they did and how they kind of engaged in these legitimating practices.
Well, a couple of things sort of jumped to mind. So I think you'd find the sort of lower resourced NGOs would be far more emphatic of their volunteer network.
Mm-hmm.
I explore in the book how Advocates International, the international NGO, was the only organization that had abandoned the use of volunteers, and it clearly was in a position to do so. It actually used a child sponsorship model, which was problematic in its own right, but it had a certain amount of sort of independent resourcing that wasn't tied to a particular project that allowed them to develop in new areas and so on. And there's a quote in there in the book with the NGO worker on the cover who said, you know, people will volunteer these days. So in the beginning, we were all sort of under one project, Mwalim Nyerere. But you know, people have lost trust in that, and these days people will volunteer with pay and not without it, and that's how voluntary work should be understood here. Of course, paid voluntary work sort of in certain contexts seem to be a contradiction in terms, but really volunteers, I think what it means is that what he's saying is undersalaried, like underpaid labor can be part compensated, but they would never be sort of government salaried workers. So I think resource base had something to do, I think, with the emphasis of the broadcasting of voluntary networks. There were two out of the six that were membership boards. So there was one that was the Women's Network, and there was one that was people living with HIV and AIDS, and the representational claims obviously were far stronger in those contexts. That nobody really could be a better mouthpiece for the interests of to further the interests of women or other marginalized groups and so on. Who are the audiences? It's an interesting one, I think, of so your second question. I've seen various different forums. You know, this cover art was from the first foray into a new village. So it was a full village meeting, so quite performative for the village leaders. The men and the women sat separately. But I also look at sort of what I call lateral legitimation, whereby NGOs sat next to other NGOs, an almost competitive description of the sort of quarterly activities. emphasizing, I guess, again, the scale and the depth of the various interventions. And then to some degree, local government as well. So I sort of talk about partnership and VPI and its sort of echoing of the state as far as the state sort of architecture is. Sometimes sort of sat alongside the county, the district, that they would be their key audience. But the vast majority of data in the book was around the interaction with actual village level village leaders or broader village body.
Okay. You want to ask us about that?
And I have like a sort of final question.
Let me see if there's another question at the back there. Yeah, you.
Hi there, thank you. It's a fascinating lecture. And I apologise in advance for not being able to formulate a question very well, because I'm actually a practitioner and I've sort of withdrawn from work as a consultant in some of these highly complex, contested contexts where you have many, many NGOs, people suffering greatly, multiple UN and other agencies and so forth. So my question is around the tangible benefits that all of these NGOs will be claiming to deliver, because there are obviously, as you mentioned, across multiple sectors. So those that are working on SME will be, you know, having to monitor the number of small businesses they might help. Those that are helping access to agricultural markets will be making certain claims about the changes in people's lives in terms of the urgent needs they have, financial, material. Others will be trying to bring about better infrastructure or utilities and so forth. So do you have any sense how that maps in any way into legitimacy and perceptions of legitimacy, which, as you say, is a very complex thing? I mean, every single village is enormously complex in terms of the different actors, the different stakeholders. Because obviously some of them fail to deliver, some of them deliver things which are not sustainable, some of them are responsive to what people are asking for, some of them are not. So do you have any sense of how the perception of those benefits against what the NGOs claim to deliver actually relate to their legitimacy?
I think I sort of entered this district at a time of profound sort of frustration and disillusionment with district level government, but also I think just this rush of new NGO activity with like 100 new NGOs registering in a very short period of time and each coming in to try and garner some kind of recognition and public buy-in in the particular areas where they were working. And so many of these small ad hoc NGOs came in and out of view at any one point in time. So there were very few that had a continuity of presence, as I said. The frustration, I think, with Voluntary Partnership International, so the focus there was on microcredit and HIV/AIDS and human rights, especially for women. And that they were almost a proxy, I think, in certain villages for frustration with the district. So people were sort of withdrawing increasingly their consent, or at least evading working with that NGO, seen as so proximate to a district government that was seen to not be serving their interests. And that wasn't always universally true. I think in areas where there were very few NGOs, because there was partial or unequal coverage within the district, then perhaps the working relationships were better. And then the other international NGO, Advocates International, was measuring success in a different way. So doing advocacy work, it was around getting a court case, it was around getting the president to call the district commissioner to wonder why there's not a school in a particular area. So it had a bit more of a sort of reactive, agile mode of doing developmental work, which was almost quite unpredictable. So this sort of long idea of programmatic work was somehow changing for this advocacy organization who wanted to be able to react to particular political events and capitalize on that. So then it becomes difficult to sort of say, well, how's your, you know, how's your land governance program going? Because you know, it's sort of, it's quite reactionary and events will unfold and NGOs react, and that's sort of how they were increasingly doing their advocacy. They also had a child sponsorship scheme, which was also extremely problematic in measuring impact. And I explore in the book as well about how parents would refuse to allow children to be photographed on the quarterly or the annual basis because they either were seen as the benefits were not enough to that particular child, or confusion as to why child sponsorship money should go to a whole village, whereas actually the original understanding, rightly or wrongly, was that it should go into people's pockets. I don't mean, I guess there's a slightly depressing picture that I'm painting there, but I feel like it was hard to discern in this rush of organisations and registrations, and there were just sort of things emerging out of that as to who was going to be able to survive for the long term and who were just sort of capitalising on this almost gold rush of activity in Bagamoyo district. So I don't feel I've got a great answer to your question. I wasn't necessarily monitoring impact per se, but trying to sort of unpick more of these negotiating dynamics between populations and the various NGOs who are trying to intervene at particular moments in time.
Thanks, Kathy. So we have time, I think, for one more question. I'll see if anyone in the audience. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, if you could just say your name. Thank you
for that. It was very interesting. I'm Stuart Hopper, I'm an MA student at SOAS. I'm also a mature student, so I come to this from my original kind of career was in business and law. So I probably have a very different take. There's a language here that I'm not familiar with, and this might be the ultimate binary question, but isn't delivery, by whatever metric, the ultimate legitimation? Either they're there and they're doing what they said they should do, or they're not, and then there's a lack of legitimacy if they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Well, as I say, I was there quite early in a curve, and I think, NGOs write reports. They write reports that go upwards, and the perception on the ground seemed to be much more of a lack of delivery over what was originally envisaged, or more lightly, very much sort of stop start, flurries of activity, and then dormancy, and then new flurries of activity, which when I was talking about the sort of temporal extensity or trying to show continuity over time, the lack of that continuity would definitely serve to delegitimate particular organizations. But sometimes the impact that would be designated success by a particular NGO wouldn't necessarily translate that well to the local population. So that the case I'm talking about, Voluntary Partnership International, these are all pseudonyms, obviously. Success there is the number of cases reported to the police, for example, the number of court cases may be successful, land transfer, like according to the law, so that perhaps, you know, women who are entitled to inherit particular land, number of micro credit initiatives, money dispersed, you might measure that without necessarily measuring what the long-term impact is on people's lives. And then the flip side of that, I suppose, is some of the unseen challenges around this very gnarly, difficult, challenging human rights work that in some cases causing more problems than resolving, but that wouldn't necessarily be documented in your glossy annual report. I do explore, so again, I come back to this one village that was completely aligned with Advocates International and had completely fallen out of favour with the district and with Voluntary Partnership International. And this village was, you know, the poster child for a lot of AI's glossies and saying this is the exemplar of village leadership. The village chairman is taking this company to court, doing everything he can to further good land governance and so on. And then for VPI, it was the exemplar of complete failure of leadership to run all of the committees, to have the meetings, to have the village development plans. A lot of this language is very sort of state-like in the Tanzanian context. So that was designated failure. The very same village was painted in such different extremes. So I guess how impact is recorded and transmitted upwards is maybe not that binary. Maybe it's not that objective or that tangible in how you measure impact and success.
So I think we will finish there. That's been a really fascinating and provocative talk. Kathy, thank you so much. You can take many sips of water now. And it was just really lovely to have some of the insights from your really rich field work. So thank you. I hope everybody will join me. Thank you.